This is Mark Strassman, reporter with American Politics Today. We're about to speak with Michael Dixon, who's the chair of the Libertarian Party of the United States. Welcome to American Politics Today.
Thanks for having me.
To help our readers orient who you are exactly, you hold the same job with the Libertarian Party that Ed Gillespie holds with the Republican National Committee and that Terry McAuliffe holds with the Democratic National Committee. Is that right?
That is correct.
Are you appointed or elected, or how does that work?
I'm elected by the delegates in convention, and that's elected every other year.
Was that this year?
That was this spring in Atlanta.
So you're freshly elected, pretty much.
Right.
Okay. Is being chair of the Libertarian Party of the U.S., both literally and figuratively, a full-time job or not?
It is literally a full-time job, but it is not a paid position.
Oh, okay. Do you have another job that...
I am a management consultant. I work in the banking industry.
Okay. How big is the Libertarian Party?
Membership right now, dues current, is about 20,000 members.
Okay. And how many people are registered as Libertarians?
Several million. And that varies by state law. In many states, we are able to register our voters. In many states, we are not.
Okay. And how many elected Libertarian Party members are there in the United States?
There are over 500 elected Libertarians in the country right now. That number is a constantly moving target.
Who are the highest elected ones?
Oh, there are many city councilmen in fairly large cities. There are also many people who have budgetary authority in other areas, water, zoning, soil and land districts, those sorts of offices.
Are there any boards or other parts of jurisdictions that Libertarians control?
There are a small number, and I could not name them by city or state, where there are 3 out of 5 Libertarians on a board. There are a couple of those in California and one, I believe, in another state.
Have they been able to implement drastically Libertarian programs in those areas?
In some places. One of the places that's been getting a lot of press lately is the town of Verona, Wisconsin,
right,
where there's a Libertarian who has been in office there, I think, for 6 years, and in each successive year, the budget of the town has gone down.
Right.
And that he doesn't control it. He's just one voice. But as one person on the board asking critical questions, he's been able to get a lot more outsourcing done and a lot more critical thinking about what should be the role of the city government.
There in Verona, has there been a noticeable improvement in the quality of life among the people who are have these elected Libertarian officials?
I think Verona was always a pretty nice place to live, I have to say.
Right.
But certainly one of the things that happens when you have an engaged political class and a group of Libertarians in that class who are asking good critical questions about what we should be doing as a government, I think it benefits everybody to get those things out on the table and discuss what is appropriate.
Okay. Now, speaking of what's appropriate, what brought you to my immediate attention here was your suggestion last week that the Democratic and Republican parties or their millionaire nominees pay back the U.S. Treasury the money that they got and will get to stage their respective promotional events in Boston and New York City. How much are we taxpayers paying to provide them with all those balloons?
Well, the federal government, our tax money, is given each of the two major parties $14.5 million. So that's a total of, what are we talking about?
Today
we're talking about $29 million here that we're giving them so that they can throw an advertising campaign on our television, viewing.
Now, who the heck appropriated that money?
Well, the Congress does that.
Would that be a Congress made up mainly or almost exclusively of Democrats and Republicans?
Absolutely, exclusively made out of Republicans and
except,
Democrats.
Except for Bernie Sanders, I guess.
Exactly. And then they also then say that the host city has to kick in the cost of the security and the extra things that have to be done locally to keep the cities running during these campaigns. Those numbers are projected at $25 million for each Boston and New York City. So this number gets really big for when we start talking about the citizens of those two cities having to kick in that extra money as well.
Now, is there a risk that they'll start carrying on and start producing weekly sitcoms instead of just specials, or what?
I grew up in the era of Watergate, and that felt like, maybe a bad miniseries.
Right.
But the real issue here is that these conventions have no function at all. The nominees are selected months ahead of time.
Right.
These conventions are purely for the enjoyment of the delegate.
Right.
And for the marketing factor on our TV screens to help put forward the best possible image of this nominee.
Well,
and both of these nominees are multimillionaires in their own right. If they wanted to buy TV time to put forward their message, they could do it with their own money.
And the parties are not impoverished either.
That's true. The parties have plenty of resources at their at their hands. Now, of course, much of that is raised from either large donor contributors or from the lobbying issue, from the corporations that are giving large sums of money to get access and influence legislation in their own right.
Now, you mentioned that you were elected at the Libertarian Convention in Atlanta earlier this year. Were there any federal subsidies for that convention?
There were no federal subsidies for our convention.
And you had an exciting race. I don't know about how exciting your race was, but the race for the presidential nomination was apparently one in which the dark horse came from behind and won the nomination.
It was truly an exciting day, a real convention where something real was decided. Three people walked in, almost a dead heat on the first ballot, and at the end of the day, we had a nominee.
Sounds like the Democrats in 1924 or something.
Similar, right.
Except fewer. Now, they had 103 ballots that time. So what was the suggestion that you made exactly? And make it again here, if you would.
Well, the suggestion is that if John Kerry and John Edwards really care about the little guy, they could give back the money to the taxpayers who put it up.
Now, have you telegram? What do you do? I don't think they have telegrams anymore. Did you send them an email about this?
We sent word through, and we didn't hear back from John Kerry or John Edwards. And let's be perfectly frank, I would make the same suggestion in a few weeks,
right,
when George Bush and Vice President Cheney have their, you know, taxpayer subsidized advertising campaign as well.
Right.
You know, all of these guys could afford to buy their own space. Interestingly enough, the nominees haven't gotten back to us, but an awful lot of the media has called, and I've done just dozens of interviews with people around the country saying this very thing. The people in this country are sick of paying for this kind of showmanship.
Now, this is really the tip of the iceberg, though, isn't it, in terms of money going to federal money circulating around with lobbyists and the Republicans and Democrats and the legislators and so on?
Well, there's certainly an awful lot of money contributed directly to candidates, directly to host committees, directly to the soft money world, which, of course, they told us was outlawed.
But now it's called 527, apparently.
It's now called 527 money. The big loophole that nobody wants to talk about is the host committee loophole. You know, soft money was outlawed. Corporations cannot give money to the parties anymore.
Did you support that? Party support that?
I don't know how I feel about it. I think the whole thing is sort of a morass of rules, and I'd rather have no rules and lots of disclosure.
Right.
Right now we have lots of rules and no disclosure. Right. We have approximately $100 million given to the host committees. Those are the sort of unofficial party apparatchiks who run these committees,
right,
who run these conventions. $105 million in Boston to run that, and that $105 million went right onto the top of the prices of the goods and services that you and I and every other taxpayer pays when we go to the stores. You know, the corporations didn't give that money out of their profits. They gave it out of their operating funds, and it raises the prices of everything that we buy.
Now, there was also, in addition to the federal money that went to the Democrats, it's going to the Republicans, is the fact that the television networks covered the exceedingly non-eventful Democratic convention. They're going to cover the exceedingly non-eventful Republican convention. But I guess C-SPAN covered the Libertarian convention?
C-SPAN did cover the nomination day of our convention and the presidential nominee debate the day before.
So that was something.
Right.
But it was, but that probably had more content in it than all the days of the Democratic and Republican conventions together that were covered 3 hours a night on the networks.
Very possibly. There was actually real competition there. It wasn't just a setup for one guy. It was
right.
Three different people who were making individual cases about why they should be the nominee.
Okay, now the rest of what we're going to talk about now is about that competition. Ballot access is very important, obviously. Democrats and Republicans get ballot access by falling out of bed in the morning. What about Libertarians?
It varies state to state. In many states, we have ballot access. In many other states, we merely have to file a bond or pay a fee. In some states, we are still required to petition, in other words, to circulate ballot petitions and get citizens to sign for us. Some states, that's relatively small, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 signatures. In other states, it's quite large. In North Carolina, we will probably gather a little over 100,000 signatures next year to retain our ballot slot.
Now, is this done on the basis of any kind of stated principle or just we got it, you don't, ha-ha?
The stated principles typically from the judicial branch of the government are that they are protecting the sanctity of the ballot. They're preserving the ballot from interlopers who might not be serious candidates.
The assumption being that the Democrats and Republicans are serious candidates.
Exactly.
And everyone else is
and
not.
The assumption that if you were opposing them, you were by some means not serious, or that you weren't to be trusted with that very important slot there.
Right. Now, is that just a result of historical happenstance, or is it because the people in power now are either Democrats or Republicans, and they just come up with whatever kind of flimsy excuse they want?
I'm not sure of a historical precedent for it. I think that the people in power are going to look for ways to retain power. I think they're also going to look for ways to make life manageable and administratively simple for the government employees that have to run the ballot.
Is the fact that only 70% of the people who are eligible to vote are registered, of the people who are registered to vote, half or fewer than half are voting, and therefore the number of people, the percentage of people necessary to elect someone or pass an initiative is somewhere between 10% and 20% now?
Well, it's certainly true that that's a hindrance to us when we circulate ballot petitions.
Because
only people who are registered may sign a ballot petition.
Right.
And I find it fascinating. I have moved in the course of my adult life many times. My career has moved me around the country. And all of my pre-market interactions, you know, my American Airlines frequent flyer card and various transactions I have with software vendors and such,
right.
Every time I move, they have no trouble at all finding me.
Right.
But every time I move, it's a real pain in the neck to re-register to vote.
So are you recommending some kind of national registration?
Not necessarily a national registration, but I don't understand why I have to go to a specific building that's never in a convenient part of town.
Right.
On very restricted hours of the day.
Right.
You know, like 9 to 4 Monday through Friday, and
right.
stand in a long line in order to be allowed to register.
Right, whereas you
sometimes
can take your frequent...
I get grief from the local constable
right.
who doesn't like the way I want to register.
Right.
You know, when every other thing that I want to do, I can just dial up online, go into a password-encoded screen, and
right.
fill it out, and I'm done.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. After a candidate gets on the ballot, the next thing he or she wants to do, of course, is to get into the debates, especially when they're televised. Are libertarians routinely included or excluded from televised political debates? What?
Routinely excluded from debates.
On the same basis on which they're excluded from the ballot, presumably.
Certainly. If you are not perceived to already have, you know, significant support, you will be excluded from the debate.
Isn't this a little catch-22-ish?
Yes. It's certainly difficult to get your name out and get your message out if you're excluded from the primary vehicle of marketing yourself.
Does the irony of any of this ever seep into the thinking or speaking of any of the officials that you've encountered?
Not that I've encountered, no.
Because if they say, we won't put you on the ballot, we won't put you into the debates because you're not serious, because nobody likes you, because nobody agrees with you, and then you say, excuse me, nobody hears us, and they say, well, that's your problem.
Nobody knows who we are.
Right.
Right.
So what kind of tactics or strategy are libertarians using to try to get out of this vicious circle?
Well, we do a couple of different things. We often resort to the streets with our signs and our chants, and that's, you know, the time-honored traditional method.
Right. What are some? You have some standard national chants?
No, actually, we don't. Unfortunately,
okay. Okay.
I've been championing a theme song for the party, but I'm not getting as much traction as I'd like on that.
All right.
But I will say that the more viable way to do this, which is the methodology that Judge Gray has pursued in his Senate campaign in California this year, is to commission a poll to show what his actual support is.
Right.
And then take that poll to the debate entity in the state of California that happens to be the League of Women Voters and say, look, I do have not, you know, a plurality or a majority, but I have significant support here, and I deserve to be included in the debate for that reason.
Okay, well, actually, as the person who's most closely covered that particular story, let me repeat and tell you that I covered that issue exactly about his commissioning a Rasmussen Reports poll. He got 8%. The poll also revealed that 18% of the people polled said that if the election came down to them among the three candidates for the Senate, they'd pick him. 18% said that.
Wow.
Now, only 8% said they'd vote for him.
Yeah.
And I perceive this to mean that 8% were going to vote for him, whatever, but a lot of people, for example, about 10% would have liked to have voted for him, but they didn't think he could win. Therefore, they didn't want to, quote, waste their vote. Therefore, they were going to vote for a Democrat or Republican or not vote. But when asked if your vote made the difference, meaning if he had a chance to win, how would you vote? 18% said they'd vote for him. Now, the League of Women Voters said, nobody gets into our debates who doesn't have 10%, and we're being generous there. He got 8% in the direct question. He got 18% in the if it depended on you question. And I interviewed the woman who runs the League of Women Voters operation for that, and she said it's a push poll. It's not an independent poll. He paid for it. He's out. So, but I can report that I got an email a few minutes ago from his campaign saying that they're suing the League of Women Voters. And I'm going to be interviewing him after I'm done interviewing you, and we're going to see how that goes. But that's where things stand and why in California.
It is true. It is true that he chose this litigation route after he did everything else that he could. Interestingly enough, one other thing that we have found historically is that often the media won't cover us when we make a policy pronouncement.
Right.
And they might not cover us when we hold an event.
Right.
But if we sue someone,
right,
it's news.
Yeah, they like it. If it,
and, you know, they love a lawsuit.
If so it litigates, it leads, right.
Often that is what we end up doing, is filing an action against someone.
Right.
Sometimes against the government, sometimes against an individual, sometimes against a third party like the League of Women Voters. The goal being, A, to encourage them to change their position, and B, to pick up a bunch of media out of that maneuver.
Well, it's clear that a lot of change, social change in the United States in the last half century has taken place through litigation, from Brown versus Board of Education and so on. So,
on to a whole lot of other things. That's absolutely right.
Right. Okay. What I'd like to do, you talked about the substance a little bit. The media doesn't cover it. I'm going to cover it. Let's take a few minutes, if we can, and sort of go over the very concise statement of the libertarian philosophy that's up on your website that we're going to link to and people can learn more about. But why don't we just talk about the three main points, if we could, for a few minutes. The Libertarian Party, it says, is committed to America's heritage of freedom in particular. Individual liberty and personal responsibility. What are those two things mean? What do those two things mean to you? And what's the relationship between them?
Well, it means that no one other than you can decide what's best for you and your life and your family and your personal financial and social circumstances. Absolutely, you can't talk about liberty without talking about responsibility. Is you've got to own the results of your own actions. And if you choose to live a certain way, you've got to own the responsibility to stand up to whatever the results might bring.
So in practice, let's just see if this is at all relevant. You can use whatever kind of drugs you feel like, but if you get into trouble with them, it's up to you to take care of that, not the state. Is that a
correct
fair statement?
That's
on that?
That's a very fair way of describing it, right.
Now, in terms of economically, well, let's maybe come back to individual liberty after we deal with the second point, which is a free market economy of abundance and prosperity, and there are two parts there. Tell us what you mean exactly by a free market economy. Is this presumably whatever Milton Friedman thinks is a good idea, or what?
I think Milton's a pretty good guy. It means that I should be allowed to contract and sell the worth that I produce in whatever way I want.
Which means, how about emitting pollution to produce whatever you want?
Well, pollution is going to harm somebody.
Right.
I can't do that without making the person harmed whole.
All right.
Whatever that might mean. It might mean buying the right to do so.
Right.
Or it might mean compensating the people downstream if we're talking about water pollution.
Right.
It means that I own the responsibility for those actions.
Well, let's say
it also means that I should be allowed to enter an industry.
Right.
You know, if I want to start offering to taxi people around in the back seat of my car,
right,
I should be allowed to do that without the infringement of the city or county government saying, oh, well, we have plenty of taxis already. We don't need any more.
Does anybody have the right to force you to pay for insurance?
No.
And what happens if you don't have insurance and you cause a problem?
I own the responsibility and the cost therein.
And if you don't have that money, what happens?
Well, that's something that the insurance industry's got to deal with, doesn't it? Don't they?
Well, I don't know. I'm trying to find out what the trade-off is between what people do, what corporations do, and what the state does.
But individually, I have the right to purchase the kinds and types of insurance I want,
or none at all,
or none at all. And thinking about auto insurance, which is the way that most people normally think about this,
right,
case. One of the issues would be, right now the government issues me the right to drive,
right,
and then attempts to regulate the insurance I buy.
Right.
Wouldn't it make a lot more sense if the insurers issued the driver's licenses?
Well, but who would license the insurance companies as? I see. So everyone would essentially have a bigger tag on their car saying I'm insured by Allstate, I'm insured by 21st Century, and then that's an interesting. Okay, well, let's devote another program later to giving the licenses out through the insurance companies. Foreign policy, but a bigger point though, the free market economy. It says here of abundance and prosperity. I think in logic we call that begging the question. Is it a certainty that a free market economy creates abundance and prosperity?
No, it probably isn't an absolute certainty. On the other hand, there's a fairly strong case to be made that regulatory constraints are holding back productive capacity. Because they're keeping people from entering industries that they would like to enter into.
Right. All right. Well, that's going to be worth two shows also, but at least we've got your position on it. A foreign policy of non-intervention, peace, and free trade, how would that specifically apply, say, for example, to invading large Middle Eastern countries?
Our party's position is that there was absolutely no justification for the action in Iraq, that there was, if anything, very limited justification for the action in Afghanistan. Our party's position is that there is absolutely no justification for having our troops stationed in, 138 different countries around the globe?
Something like that.
As some sort of a tripwire against whatever it is we're against this year.
Right.
Our position is very clear. It is to bring our boys home now, defend our nation and our boundaries here at home, and make sure that our circumstances are preserved. There's no justification within our worldview for offensive or aggressive actions in any way.
Now, I guess, well, I won't guess, I'll ask you. The war on terrorism / homeland security effort, closely linked as it is with the Patriot Act, invasion of foreign countries, and other steps, what's the libertarian position on that?
We have problems with this on a lot of different levels. We have problems with the invasion of foreign countries. We also have problems with the list-keeping and internal snooping and spying and keeping track of what books I checked out of the library and that kind of stuff, because in some way that's going to protect us from another 9/11.
Right. That's the theory.
Our position is very clear. People do bad things, and when they do bad things, they need to be punished. When crime is committed, it needs to be punished. Crime is force and fraud and nothing more. If it's committed by an external terrorist, that's fine. It's force or fraud that needs to be dealt with.
So is there some kind of ideological reason why the government converts what you consider criminal acts into acts of political terrorism?
I think it's just jingoism of the worst type.
Speaking of jingoism, the Democrats at their convention seem just as patriotic as the Republicans are going to seem at theirs. In fact, there seems to be this escalating bidding war as to who is more patriotic. What's the libertarian view on patriotism?
Libertarians are, the farther down some of these roads you go, the less monolithic we are.
Right.
There are many libertarians who are citizens of the world.
Right.
There are many libertarians who are very staunch patriots about the origins of this country.
Right.
And the founding fathers of this country. I think that we want a strong America, that it's a great place for us to live and raise our children.
Okay. Now, there are a lot of people out there demonstrating against the Patriot Act and against the war in Iraq who aren't libertarians, and I'm sure few would say they're Republicans. Some might say they're Democrats. What efforts, if any, or how naturally is it happening without effort for the libertarians to recruit the people who share your view but might not necessarily think of themselves as libertarians? If you see what I'm saying.
I think that's something that we would like to have happen. I would not say that it's something that happens very often, though.
You do know what I'm talking about. Essentially, yeah. People who are, for lack of a better term, countercultural, and who are left and feel that way. But your position there, not to mention people who want to legalize marijuana, let's take them, throw them in there also. I see a whole lot of people there on what you'd call the left or the countercultural side who share positions with the Libertarian Party but don't feel affiliated with the Libertarian Party. Have you noticed that? Is that an issue for you?
Well, certainly there are. However, one of the problems that we run into always is a broader spectrum. those people may be very, very agitated on that one issue, and that's where we see them activated.
Right.
But they also hold other positions which are not ours.
For example, anti-globalism, as they see it, or mm-hmm. presumably anti-free trade, as you see it, right?
As we see it, exactly.
What about that dichotomy, that there are groups of people who agree with you on some of your issues, but are pretty much diametrically opposed to you on others?
We would see that as an educational effort, that we need to show them why there's a consistency to, for instance, you know, if you believe that it's appropriate that you be allowed to own, use, and enjoy recreational drugs,
right,
then why do you not think it's okay for your neighbor to own, use, and enjoy recreational firearms?
Because I would say the fun you can have with guns is different than the fun you can have with marijuana,
certainly different fun, but as long as it's privately enjoyed in the privacy and safety of your own dwelling or your own property, wrong
with it? Let's try to focus on that just
for
a minute.
It's an educational process that we need to help people understand.
All right.
Other side of these things.
Well, or is it a cultural issue? Because people who enjoy having fun with guns don't seem to be the same people who enjoy having fun with recreational drugs, are they?
They very often aren't, and they both want to be left alone in their own area.
They want to be left alone, right?
And they sure don't want to leave their neighbors alone in their favorite recreational area.
All right, we'll have to work that one out, too. What substantively and concisely distinguishes the Libertarian Party on the issues from the Dem-Rep duopoly, if we can call it that?
Try me one more time.
Right. What are the crucial substantive distinctions on the issues between the Libertarian Party and the Democratic-Republican duopoly? In other words, what do the Libertarians believe?
That nobody else does?
Well, that the Democratic... What can people get from the Libertarians that they can't get from the Democratic and Republican choices?
Well, I think it's about individualism, and it's about freedom to make your own choices. It is also about the responsibility to live with those choices and the freedom to respect your neighbors or you know, quite frankly, to ignore their behaviors if they aren't yours. I think it's a willingness to let everybody do their own thing as long as they're not harming anybody.
Do you think that that being a libertarian demands a higher level of mental acuteness to understand what the philosophy is than either the Democrats or Republicans do?
No, I don't think so at all.
No.
I think that if presented clearly, these are kitchen table issues.
Okay.
Do you want to be allowed to live your life and raise your family the way you desire to? And I think the answer is yes. I think everybody would say, yeah, I wanna live my life and raise my kids and participate in my church and my community the way I want to.
Okay, because I've been thinking about this somewhat more than usual in preparation for this discussion. And it seems that being a Democrat offers certain assurances to people about what's up and what's not and what and how to live and who's in charge and so on, as does the Republican Party. And they're essentially worldviews that the government among the Democrats, to oversimplify, that the government ought to be, you know, redistributing the money and the decision making from individuals to the government, and among the Republicans that the corporations ought to have the power to control what happens to people. And presumably the Libertarians have a third position on this, but most people who are politically involved are comfortable with either the Democratic or the Republican alternative. The country is divided 46-47 or 47-46 on this.
They clearly, both the Democrat and the Republican positions offer a comfort of a security.
Right, exactly.
Somebody else is going to worry about this for you.
To use Eric Fromm's phrase, an escape from freedom.
Mm-hmm. And it's going to give you that security. It's going to allow you to be comfortable knowing that this group is looking out for you.
That's right.
In both cases, the group is big blank, big something, big
right.
government, big business,
right.
big social programs, big X.
Right.
And in the libertarian worldview, you know, we're not looking for anybody to take care of us that way.
It sounds like rugged individualism.
We want to be allowed to do this ourselves. Now, that doesn't mean we're individualists, so I'll go one step further.
Right.
What it means is we're allowed to choose who we want to associate with. I mean, a fraternal organization is very much within the libertarian worldview.
Right.
That a church or a lodge or a freely joined cooperative
right.
are all well within the libertarian worldview. None of those entities has the right to tax or spend anybody else's money. They're only there to serve their members.
Let's say libertarians are wildly successful, and it's a few years from now, and we have a libertarian government at all levels. What will the United States look like?
Well, I would hope it would be a friendlier place.
Okay.
You know, I think over the last 20 years maybe, we've seen the politicization of everything in this country. You know, you can't have an opinion about anything in this country without it being inferred to your political position.
Right.
I would love to see a withering of the state in all areas because there'd be less at stake with it. Who would really care who was running, you know, whatever level of government we were talking about, if that level of government didn't have the power to control so much of our daily lives? Why do I really care who runs my community? Because they have control over the taxes. They have control over the schools. They have control over the roads and the bridges and all different kinds of things. Why wouldn't it be great if we could reduce the power of the government so that it became sort of a non-issue to us and we could all get back to just living our lives?
Who would defend the country against foreign aggression?
I think the government would still have to do that. I think there is a place for some level of government at that kind of a globalist level, yeah, that we would need to have border, you know, sentries, if you will. There would have to be some sort of function for that federal government.
What about that's a long
sight from what we have now, isn't it?
It is. What about the problem of a radically free market system devolving into a system of monopoly and oligopoly controlled by corporations who are able to work more efficiently and get the job of delivering services, which may become every bit as antithetical to the liberty of individuals as the worst totalitarian government, minus maybe the blatant genocide that they often try to commit?
It certainly could, and now you're back to the Milton Friedman discussion.
Okay.
You know, clearly, if those oligarchs were providing products and services at the prices that the masses wanted them at, no one would go in competition with them.
No one could go in competition with them.
The minute that they became abusive of their authority, something would have to give in the market economy that would cause somebody else to either produce the same product differently or produce an alternative product differently.
But let's try to be in the real. Let's try to be in the real world for a second. In the today, I mean, I have a choice essentially of one phone company, three computer companies. There is monopoly in all. Few airlines is in flux. Airlines are in flux, so it's kind of an interesting issue because the big monopolies or oligopolies are going out of business, and the little ones are coming in. So that's a good argument in your favor. But in a lot of other markets, there are single corporations, or Microsoft Corporation, for example, or two or three others that control the market. They deliver, in many cases, good services. That's how they got to be as powerful as they are. But they have. They're just one or two government decisions away from being able to raise their prices to maximize their profits and exclude other people, both customers and competitors, and do what they want. They are working on a global scale now, and they're controlling the most important resources of telecommunications and computing and maybe water and food and so on. What about the threat, not from government oppression, but from corporate control? What's the libertarian take on that? Milton Friedman, to the contrary, there's nothing to worry about notwithstanding.
There's always the concern of that, but I would say the mere fact that you've described it as being a current problem begs the question of, is it a result of free markets or is it a problem of radically controlled markets? In many of the industries that you described where we have limited choice, those are industries where it is very difficult for a new provider to get into the marketplace.
Because of regulatory requirements.
Because of regulatory requirements or restrictions.
So even if someone did raise $1 billion in capital and said, I want to get into the telecommunications business, the problem isn't that SBC could underprice them, but that the FCC wouldn't allow them to go into business in the first place.
In one manner or another, absolutely.
Okay.
And I would say that much like the airline industry, I think the phone industry is getting really interesting right now.
Well, that's because voice over IP stands to challenge it. But my guess is that as soon as this looks set, that SBC will buy Vonage, and we'll be back where we started.
And we might be. That's absolutely true.
Yes. Okay. Speaking of free markets, do you think there's now a free market in political ideas and in elections? And if not, how is the Libertarian Party trying to establish one?
No, I think a free market in elections will happen when there's more openness to the ballot line.
Right.
However, I think in the area of ideas, I think there has been a radical change in the last 20, 30 years. In that 20 or 30 years ago, you know, there were a handful of libertarians, And it would be relatively easy for you to know all of the major people in the movement and all of what they were up to, all the books that were being written, all the journals that were being published in. Today, it is a much more open industry as far as the ideas go, and not only is there more of it in our wing of the political spectrum, but there's a whole lot more of it cross-pollinating throughout the major media. As much as I would say the media excludes us from the political reporting and the debating, they certainly talk about a lot of our issues. Look at free deregulation of the various industries, the airline industry for one, the phone industry for another. What about discussions of privatizing Social Security or privatizing health insurance away from employer-provided health insurance? These are all ideas that started in our end of the political spectrum and have now become relatively mainstream political concepts.
All right. Well, then there is a relative free market. Do you expect that a libertarian government, and this is a hypothetical, would be any more sympathetic to dissent or any more supportive of those seeking to replace it than the Democratic-Republican duopoly is now by its very nature, or will it be instantiated
by people?
You would always
think that of your own movement, but I am rather a cynic about those in power, and that's why I want to reduce the amount of power they could ever wield.
So are you sort of saying that libertarians are not seeking to replace the personnel, but the system, and create a system that has less bureaucratic and executive power, able to influence people's lives, so there's, by that theory, never any danger that there'll be that libertarians in power is kind of an oxymoron under the best of circumstances?
Right. Yes.
Okay. Are you working with other non-Democratic or Republican parties to reform the electoral system in some sort of grand alliance that would let you get on the ballot and then fight it out over your ideas?
In some states, we have alliances with other minor parties where we're working on lobbying for changes in ballot access laws. That's a big part of what we do, yes.
Okay. What are you doing yourself now as the chair of the party on a day-to-day basis during the election season?
As the chairman of the party, I'm not directly involved in the presidential campaign.
Right.
My function is to administer the party structure itself.
Okay.
There's a parallel structure to me, which runs the presidential campaign. We obviously discuss back and forth at that level what each other are up to, but it's not something that I'm involved in on a day-to-day basis.
Okay. And what's your scenario for? Well, we can't call it taking power anymore. What do you call it? Of installing libertarian ideas and changing the government. What do you call it?
The message there is very simple. We will do as the national party the big picture branding, marketing, name recognition stuff.
Right.
And we'll run presidential candidates and we'll do those kind of things.
What we will do to
actually change the world,
right,
is we will continue to elect our members to positions of authority in their communities, where they will positively affect the life and the quality of life in those communities, which will cause free markets, freedom, liberty, responsibility, all of that stuff to be thought of better, which will then ultimately evolve into a smaller, less intrusive state.
So the plan is to elect people to positions of authority that they want by their ideas to undermine, and then spread that until the new ideas take over.
Yeah, I don't think I'd really use undermine because it has such a negative connotation. We just want to reduce the amount of influence the state has on everyday life.
Okay, what's the most frustrating part of your work?
Oh, I don't. I love what I do. You wouldn't take a job like this unless you truly enjoyed it.
What's the most satisfying part of your work?
Seeing the membership of our party grow and seeing it get into positions where it can influence the country.
And as specifically as you want to be, what are your expectations for November, this November, electorally, for the party?
Gee, I don't know. We will see a big bump in the number of elected libertarians. We do in every election cycle.
Right.
I don't really pick numbers out of a hat for what I think Mr. Bednarik will do at the presidential line.
Right.
He's running a pretty active campaign, and I think he's going to achieve some big numbers for us.
Okay. Any other things that people ought to know about libertarians before we go?
No, I don't think so. I just appreciate the chance to spread our message a little bit.
Okay, well, thanks for spreading it here. And hopefully we'll talk to you again during the campaign and see how things are going. And beyond that, as the ideas spread around a little further.
Great. I'm always here and available to talk.
Good. Thanks very much.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Right. Bye.